They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh. So when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two to one be mine?
So good evening everybody and welcome to the great Sherlock Holmes debate. 10th of November, 8 o'clock GMT. I'm going to go for a very quick introduction for you, but I will keep it sweet and short. Sherlock Holmes has been around for 124 years, since 1887, and Conan Doyle is often referred to as the father of all modern fiction, crime fiction. It's one of the most recognised fictional characters in the world, not just for the generation that Conan Doyle was there, but for many generations. And I have to say, there's never been a better time to be a Sherlock Holmes fan. I'm sure the guys are going to agree on the debate tonight. Now, just wanted to tell you how the debate came about, and it's just a very quick introduction to that. We've been a Sherlock Holmes publisher for a number of years now, and we're growing really quickly. We've got a lot of new authors all the time, and we got this new author called Charlotte Ann Walters. And she set herself a quite mammoth challenge, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, which is to read and review every single Sherlock Holmes story in a row, one every day. So she's done 56 Sherlock Holmes stories in 56 days to celebrate the launch of her debut novel, Barefoot on Baker Street. And she's currently near the end. So we decided to set this debate just before the end of her mammoth task. And she actually finishes on Monday, so I encourage you guys to give her all the support as she gets to the last few days. Let's talk about the audience. We've got fans from an amazing 23 different countries, USA, China, Singapore, Japan, as we mentioned before, Finland, etc. And a big thank you goes out to everybody in the audience and also for all the participation on all the forums on SherlockHolmes.com, who very kindly have set up a dedicated forum for this. So, this is the question for the debate. It's not which is best, which is the best adaptation, as some people have interpreted it, but it really is, this is the key question, which is which modern adaptation is contributing most to the ongoing legacy of Sherlock Holmes. So, for the benefit of all those people that couldn't come along this evening, we've put three video clips in just to remind people what we're talking about here. So a clip from BBC Sherlock, a clip from Warner Brothers, and also a clip from The Traditionalist as well. In our testing earlier this week, we wanted to play these clips for you, but we actually can't because the internet can't cope with that on webinar software. So it was too juddery. But just if you want to after the event, go and have a look. But I'm sure as big fans on in the audience, you will have you'll have seen all these clips anyway. So just a quick review of the debate format. First thing is we're going to tell you about the audience pre-debate vote. So all the audience members were asked to vote for their favourite team beforehand. Then we're going to have three quick five-minute presentations from each team. It's an open debate. Questions can come in from the audience via the question window, and we're already starting to see them come through. And then we're going to have an audience post-debate vote, and we'll do that by email. So we ask all the audience members to email us in their vote, and then we're going to publish to see if the voting has changed anything at all. Okay, so here is the much-awaited audience pre-vote. Let's have a look. And the audience pre-vote comes in at... I'm not trying to be over suspenseful. There we go. BBC Sherlock with 52 votes. Warner Brothers with 3 votes. So tough on there for you there, Bert. The Traditionalist with 9, and then 9 people couldn't make a choice between the teams. So let's go forward and introduce you to Team One. So Team One is team captain is the Baker Street Babes. And the team members are Sherlockology, which is one of the world's leading, not the leading, well, fan site for Sherlock Holmes in the world. It's certainly the best one. We've got Roger Johnson from the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. He edits their journal. Charlotte Walters, who's the author of Barefoot on Baker Street. Dan Andriacco, who we've heard his dulcet tones already tonight. No Police Like Holmes and Baker Street Beat. And Kate Workman is also on Team One. And she has two novels, Rendezvous at the Populaire and I Will Find the Answer. So at this point, I'm going to hand over. And of course, we're going to mention Tracy Revels, Shadowfall and Shadowblood, fantasy Sherlock Holmes books as well. So Team One, we're going to hand over to Christina from the Baker Street Babes.
Hello, this is Christina, a.k.a. Carly, from the Baker Street Babes for Team One BBC Sherlock. Our argument is going to touch on the following points. How true Sherlock is to the canon, the emphasis on John Watson as the original narrator, the use of London and the updated settings, how Sherlock Holmes is a modern man written for his contemporaries, Sherlock's wide and diverse audience attraction, the massive fan ownership of the show and its popularity, and finally, in conclusion, how Sherlock is the 21st century Sherlock Holmes. So without further ado, Sherlock is incredibly true to the canon, and there are an innumerable amount of canon references in these episodes. And the examples we're going to show are just a few. Sherlock still has the same habits and tics as seen here with steepling of his fingers and the three-pipe problem being converted to a three-patch problem. And John Watson is still a soldier returned home from Afghanistan from being shot in the shoulder, just like in the canon. A fine marksman, he's still a crack shot. Sherlock has made John's leg bother him because of PTSD, his limping psychosomatic. A clever play on Dr. Watson's leg bothering him in the canon, which was when he was just shot in the shoulder. I'll debate on that continuity aside. A Study in Pink is littered with canonical references, but we'll just touch on a few. We have the jackknife in the mantelpiece and Sherlock deducing John's cell phone instead of a pocket watch, though both belong to his sibling. Sherlock's methods of deduction and study of crime scenes is lifted from the canon as well, as you can read from this excerpt from A Study in Scarlet. Likewise, the cabbie Jeff Hope still has an aneurysm, just as his scarlet counterpart Jefferson Hope does, just in a different place. The Blind Banker is the most original of the three episodes, but it does drive from inspiration of The Adventure of the Dancing Men and The Valley of Fear. Both play with ciphers, and Su Lin Yao, her brother, and the Black Lotus are from the gang in Vermissa Valley. The Great Game, too, is littered with canon references, the most notable being Sherlock shooting the wall in a shape, this time a smiley face instead of Victoria Regina, and his lack of knowledge about the solar system. Probably my favorite part, the final standoff between Sherlock and Jim is almost lifted from the canon. Moffat and Gatiss loved these stories. They didn't want to deter too far from them, but they wanted to make them their own. John Watson was the original narrator, and he is again. He is the audience surrogate. In the modern update, John is a well-educated military man and a doctor, his blog becoming the cases. Sherlock develops him as a character, and given his amount of screen time, he's not just a sidekick, and he's definitely not bumbling. London is its own feature in Sherlock. By being updated, Sherlock can use London as it is. No green screen or sound stages like the traditional adaptations and Guy Ritchie's will have to use. Modern London is its own character in Sherlock, and it's very real to today's audience. The updated setting is key to the show's success. Sherlock Holmes still has something to say in an age where modern forensics exist. The show can be enjoyable even to someone who has never read the stories, and to those who are hardened Sherlockians, but with such references as James Fillmore in A Study in Pink, referencing the boy who went to fetch his umbrella in the canon. All of the canons are at home in today's world. They're not Victorian personalities awkwardly slotted into a world of electronics. You know, not everyone can appreciate the Victorian setting with its handsome cabs, but everyone can relate to London's black cabs and to texting. Sherlock Holmes was written by Arthur Conan Doyle for his contemporaries. By transporting Sherlock to the 21st century, Moffat and Gatiss have honored that. Every update is logical. Of course, Sherlock will send texts instead of telegrams. The performances of Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman are also to thank for the show's success. They're amazing performances, no one can deny that, and they are the right age. Holmes and Watson are usually portrayed as men in their 40s or 50s, but they would have been little older than 30 when they had just met. Sherlock helped boost the sales of the canon 180% during the first series broadcast, proving it was a perfect gateway to the original stories. For something to have a significant impact, it must engage with the wildest possible range of people. Sherlock is more likely to make someone want to read the original stories. If someone starts reading them after watching the Ritchie film, they could be very disappointed to find that the books aren't full of violence, action, slashes, and bangs. But Sherlock prepares an audience well for the intelligence and method in the canon. Modern-day Holmes writers must be innovative to attract a new audience, or else the genre will stagnate. And Sherlock is innovative in the right way. It's cerebral, detailed, and capturing the essence of the original characters. The fan base for Sherlock is extraordinary, as you can see by these figures. The internet has become the conferences for today's Sherlockians, a place where like-minded fans can talk about the series with one another. Thousands and thousands of fans have congregated onto the likes of LiveJournal and Tumblr, as well as other websites. The series is internationally beloved and growing. As you can see, the viewing figures for the UK are well into the millions, and Study in Pink only came second to David Tennant's Water on Mars, the highest viewed drama program in the UK's history. So, you know, there's that. And of course, Sherlock has won an incredible amount of awards, most notable as Best Drama Series and Best Supporting Actor at last year's BAFTAs. And here are just some more that they've won. An incredible amount, and they've been nodded for 18 more awards, including the Emmys, both in the United States and the international ones as well. In conclusion, Sherlock is the ultimate proof that as long as you treat classic characters with complete and total respect, it doesn't matter where you place them in time, they will endure. So really, what better way to contribute to Holmes in the 21st century than an adaptation set in the present day that thus focuses on the characters rather than the era in which it is set? What BBC Sherlock does is prove Sherlock Holmes is a character that translates to an audience no matter what time period he is presented in. Anyone who watched BBC Sherlock knows, even though it's set in the 21st century London, it's still Sherlock Holmes. The man who sees things no one else can. It's the stories Arthur Conan Doyle wrote over 100 years ago that people are enjoying. It doesn't matter where it's set. So many thanks to my other babes, Artie, Taylor, and Jen, who can't be here, Sherlockology, Emma, Jules, and David, Dan Andriacco, Charlotte Walters, Roger Johnson, Tracy Revels, Kate Workman, for all of your help. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Christina. And now we move on to Team 2, so Warner Brothers. So the team captain, speaking for the team captain, I hear of Sherlock everywhere tonight, is Bert Walder. So welcome, Bert. In the team, there is Jerry O'Hara, the film director, a wonderful blog, Better Homes and Gardens. Larry Feldman, who is a society founder in the USA and a long-term Sherlock Holmes Journal editor, Kieran McMullen, Author of two great books, Watson's Afghan Adventure and a new one that's just come out, Sherlock Holmes and the Irish Rebels, and Gerry Kelly, British author of the Outstanding Mysteries of Sherlock Holmes. So I'm going to pass over to Bert. Good evening, Bert.
Well, good evening, Steve, and good evening, everyone. I'm very proud to represent the team and the Warner Brothers film Sherlock Holmes. Two things that I hope to convince you of. First, that the film was created for a mass audience and by any measure has been successful. And second, that the film was made with reverent attention to the Sherlock Holmes canon and has brought Holmes and Watson to a new global audience. That modern audience focus is apparent. The people in the seats in theaters today expect explosions and thrills and excitement, exploding shipyards, leaps to certain death, amazing special effects, and by any measure, the film has been wildly successful. It's generated $500 million in sales, and probably 50 million people worldwide have seen it and enjoyed it. As in the canon, in the film, Holmes faces powerful adversaries and truly frightening villains. And putting this on the screen is a challenge because Holmes, as a character, is always far ahead of the audience and far ahead of everyone around him. And on the right, you can see some of the dialogue that accompanies Holmes' first battle when we meet him on screen, the speed of his deductions, the actions that follow, and that lovely little bit of dialogue when almost hearkening back to Robert Downey's Charlie Chaplin, Holmes picks up that bowler hat and has that little interchange. I like the hat. Oh, yeah, I just picked it up. But making Holmes' raw intellectual prowess visually interesting on the screen is a major creative accomplishment. Throughout, the film is informed by the world that Conan Doyle created through dozens of very thoughtful underpinnings. The Baker Street rooms play a central role. And here, as in the BBC Sherlock, audiences expect to see 221B on the door, although that, of course, would not have been the number on the street. But the Holmes that we see in the film is the master of contemporary, to him, science and technology and tools. And Holmes is truly extraordinary as he confronts his nemesis in prison, as he might have confronted Moriarty, as he moves easily in and out of various disguises. He has a cabman's knowledge of London's streets and alleys. And, you know, the point the Team One made, I think is very apt. London is itself a central character in the film, which is something that this film has in common with the Moffat and Gaddis Sherlock, and I think it's very effective. But what we see is a reimagining of 19th century London in a way that makes it edgy and appealing to today's audiences. Holmes is an accomplished boxer in a very Victorian arena. And Watson has the strength of someone who served with distinction in Afghanistan. Every generation brings these characters to life again. And we seem to be living in an age of constant reboots. Star Trek is rebooted, Superman is rebooted in the comics. Guy Ritchie's film brings these people to life very refreshingly. Can anyone doubt that this Irene Adler is a match for Sherlock Holmes? Has Watson ever seemed more like a retired soldier of the Queen? Have we ever seen Mary Morstan and Watson more believably presented? And that's another thing. While a lot of attention has been paid to the action-adventure aspect of the film and to Robert Downey's characterization, the fact is that Jude Law, like Martin Freeman, you know, you really have to say, has done an amazing job creating a character with obvious depth of affection and feeling for his very strange colleague. But perhaps the best evidence is in the numbers. This is a graph from Google Ngrams, which is something you can create yourself online. The way it works is what you do is you enter a search term and Google searches its database of millions of scanned books. And so in this fashion, you could think of it as a popularity barometer. So here what I've done is I've searched the Google database of books from 1887, studying Scarlet, through 2008, which is the current limit of the database. And I've searched for references to Sherlock Holmes, not just the stories about Sherlock Holmes, but references to him in all other books during those years. And so the graph shows the impact of the films. And so if you look at the arrows down there at the bottom, Conan Doyle dies in 1930. And you can see the impact of the 1939 Hound, 20th Century Fox in 1939, does a costume hound with Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce. And then there's an uptick from 1942 through 1946. During the years that Rathbone and Bruce were making those films at Universal. Then there's a slight uptick, then drop. Then there's a slight uptick in 1959 when the Hammer Hound comes with Peter Cushing. And then there's a leap in 1974 from the 7% solution. And interestingly, so you will say to yourself, well, gee, what about what's going on the left there, that big open territory? Well, all of the films made about Sherlock Holmes from the dawn of motion pictures through the 1930s presented Holmes in the present-day garb of the time when the film was made. You know, you can remember Raymond Massey's Speckled Band, where Holmes was in this sort of Art Deco office building as the head of a huge detective agency. But the 1939 Hound was the first major production that presented Holmes in the Victorian age. And by the way, note on the right the extraordinary steady increase during Jeremy Brett's 10 years as Holmes, which is another reason to lobby for a BAFTA in recognition of his accomplishments. And one of the things we've seen in the rise of MX Publishing and in the fact that more copies of the canon are moving off the shelves is the impact, I think, of the Ritchie film in Christmas 2009. So I hope I've convinced you first that the film has been successful, that it was made with reverent attention to the Sherlock Holmes canon, and that it has introduced Holmes and Watson to a new global audience and has therefore contributed to a greater growing global awareness of the ongoing saga of Sherlock Holmes.
Thank you very much, Bert. A fantastic presentation there. So we have our first challenge of the evening, which is that our presenter, Nick, can't get on to the webinar because all the seats are filled. So that's a bit of a challenge. I was particularly looking forward to asking him to do his Dalek voice, because as many of you know, Nick is the voice of the Daleks for Doctor Who, and also the voice of the Cybermen too. So I was looking forward to that. So what we're going to do... Hello?
Steve, if you'd like... Hey, sorry. If you'd like, I can drop out. There are two other Baker Street babes on the panel, and that way you could have Nick come in, because I know he's kind of important as the team captain.
I know that. Unfortunately, even though other people have dropped out, a couple of places have dropped out during the first two presentations, it seemingly can't get in, so it seems to only...
Okay.
It seems to have locked the doors, so we have no
sorry.
Nick. We do... Thank you for the offer, though. We do have some other team members on the line from Team 3. I'm not going to put them through the pain of presenting the slides, so I'm going to whiz through the slides, but I'm just going to open up the phone line for Vida, who is on Team 3, and we also have Paul from Team 3. So apologies, guys, but we're going to load you with a tough job because you're going to get stuck with me running through the slides for Nick. Just very quickly go through the traditionalists. A key thing for the traditionalists is that with the adaptations from BBC Sherlock and from Warner Brothers, they make changes to the main canon. So the traditionalist viewpoint is that with the adaptations from Jeremy Brett and from Rathbone and from the recent ones, the audio adaptations with Nick and Martin, is that these being very true to the canon, people that convert over from these adaptations become true Sherlock Holmes fans and pick up the original canon. Paul's argument, and Paul can add more to this as well, is that the extra additions that the other two adaptations have made in terms of new villains like bankers, for example, in BBC Sherlock, etc., that are not present in the canon, and you've got the Victorian era being an essential context when you're doing an adaptation. Martin argues that Holmes is of a particular era, and to take him out of that era is a challenge. And bringing him into the 21st century has been done brilliantly by BBC Sherlock, but it's not the traditional Holmes. Vida, would you like to make your own comments here?
Well, yes, hello. It's basically what I've said here, that Sherlock works best in a Victorian setting because he presents a unique personality that is above the commonplace. But in a modern world, his skills are more commonplace than in Victorian times because literature, culture, and the streets are literature vigilantes, investigators, and heroes who are adept at meeting the kind of challenges that Holmes's intellect poses them. Though, essentially, Holmes is quintessentially Victorian, and if he were removed from the Victorian setting, he would lose some of the fascination we have with the character. That's my opinion anyway.
Thank you, Vida. Nick's final comment, I think, on here is why change perfection? You know, the Sherlock Holmes canon, as written by Conan Doyle, is quite brilliant, so you don't need to make any changes to it. So if you're going to do an adaptation of it, as like the adaptation by Big Finish coming out, The Hound of the Baskervilles, which is adapted exactly to the canon. And some statistics really from the guys, that you can stick true to the canon and still have fans from all over the world participating. So mainly English-speaking territories, but they sell all over the world the audio adaptations. And they choose very carefully what they adapt into audio. And they've chosen the Conan Doyle stories because they were so good. And didn't want to weaken the stories by changing them. They sell quite a lot of units of Sherlock Holmes. The numbers are quite small, but it's interesting that they see the biggest copyright fraud on Sherlock Holmes over and above any other type of adaptation they've done. So they do Doctor Who and various other adaptations, and it's quite interesting. It seems that when it comes to audio adaptations, that fans don't seem to really want to pay for them, which is very interesting. They're hoping that this there we go, the copyright issue there. But overall, the audio adaptations are very well received. So apologies there, guys, for slightly stumbling element of the final presentation there. And I know Nick and Martin are going to be mortified that they couldn't get in online. What we're going to do now is we're going to go to the audience questions to start off with. And I think we've got a quick question, really. I think start with Team 3. Paul and Vida, if you want to raise your hand, if you want to answer the question first. Are you, and this is a question from Steve Booth in the USA, are you concerned that traditional portrayals of Holmes are less accessible to the general public than the other two adaptations?
I can answer that. It's Paul here. Not really, no. I think possibly, and I'm only speaking for myself, obviously, but when I cast my mind back, I think perhaps the actor that most encapsulates the character for me is Jeremy Brett, without a question. And of course, in the Granada adaptations, they were quite faithful to the Victorian context. And in terms of my generation, at least, in terms of people maybe over 30 years of age, I think most of us would concur that this particular portrayal of the character was the most faithful to the canon. For me, the modern portrayals in the Warner Brothers films and the Cumberbatch are extremely interesting for many reasons that have been outlined in the two presentations. And of course, they're going to be accessible to people under the age of 30. But to me, they don't bring anything new to the character. To a man who is essentially a manifestation of good and rational reasoning, and a man who's ahead of his time. It's very difficult to be ahead of your time in a modern context. So, to me at least, I don't think they are any more accessible than people like Jeremy Brett. But then, of course, I'm speaking from the perspective of somebody over the age of 40.
Okay. This is next question to all the teams. And we'll go back to Christina for this one first. One measure of the contributing to the home's legacy can be how well the adaptation attracts newcomers back to the reading the original canon. Can you, each team, outline how your adaptation is bringing people back to read the original stories?
Sure. I mean, I guess I can start on this, and if anyone else wants to jump in, please do. I said this on numerous episodes of Rowan Podcast and in other places, that BBC Sherlock is very accessible. It appeals to people who have never read the canon, as well as people who obsess over it. Like, I know people who are very hardened Sherlockians, have been for, you know, 40, 50 plus years, but they still love it. And they're very happy that a lot of young fans, especially, are now picking up the stories. Myself, honestly, I did not pick them up until after I'd seen BBC Sherlock. And I found the character just as exciting. I loved it just as much. So, and like you saw the stats there before, like 180% sales rise while Series 1 was being shown. I don't know, did Sherlockology or Artie Taylor, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, there's also an element, particularly when you were talking about how the internet has created an easier way for us to talk, but the nods to the original canon are sort of like having your own little inside joke. And if you are someone who's not familiar with the canon, but you see other people on the internet discussing certain aspects of it and how it's represented in the stories versus how it's represented in the show, you find yourself drawn to investigating and reading those stories yourself to find out exactly what that means.
Okay, so Bert, same question to you. Do you see how has the Warner Brothers movies brought new people to read the canon?
Well, I think that, you know, the anecdotal evidence in terms of booksellers, you know, some of which has already been mentioned, is really very strong. And the advantage, I suppose, that the Warner Brothers film had is that it was just out earlier. You know, it came out at Christmas 2009 and was this sort of global juggernaut. And, of course, you know, if you see the character on screen, what you see is an extraordinary, energetic, I mean, obviously it's a very different Holmes, but it's an extraordinary, energetic Holmes and Watson in Victorian London battling evil. And so picking up the Conan Doyle stories on the shelf, you will find certainly a more sedate, but a, you know, a very, very similar character. You know, I think it's wonderful that, first of all, the wonderful thing about all this is that we all get to gather together and talk about Sherlock Holmes, which is what we love to do. But I would imagine that, you know, there could be a significant percentage of people who, having seen the Gaddis Moffat production, would go to their bookshelves looking for stories about those people. You know, particularly considering the great Moriarty cliffhanger that ended the first season. And of course, there's going to be some disappointment because you're not. You're going to be back in Victorian England with the Speckled Band and the Scandal in Bohemia and so on.
Paul, do you want to comment on that from the traditional perspective?
I think I agree almost entirely with what Bert said, not to try to prove his own argument for him, but I think my point is that increasingly, certainly in the UK, there is an increased awareness of the Victorian era. Costume dramas are becoming increasingly more popular, such as the recent ones on the BBC television. And I think, you know, culturally and historically, things tend to go around in circles. And my view on both the BBC series and on the Warner Brothers is that they are taking something which is quite a cognitive thing, and they're turning it into something that is more of a thriller. And I think my concern is that people that revisit the canon after seeing these things will be a little bit disappointed because they're not the same kind of high octane that they're presented with in those portrayals. So to me, it's a little bit misleading. I think the excitement in Sherlock Holmes is the cognitive element. So it is his ability to be a far-thinking person, well ahead of his time. And of course, these people are perhaps recreating something that we see in other genres of modern film. Like, for example, if the Warner Brothers to me reminds me of something like James Bond. It's lots of explosions, it's lots of drama, there's always something happening. I think if you go to the canon, what I like about the canon is that it's a much slower, much more progressive process, and that in itself is exciting. And I think maybe there is too much of a requirement to make things so fast moving that actually we lose that perspective on Holmes, who is a clear, objective, and rational person who thinks things through in his own time.
Going back to Team One for a moment, and a lot of people have been talking in on the message boards and the forums before the debate about the demographics that each of the teams attracts. And I've seen a comment a number of times that the demographics vary very heavily between the three different types of adaptation. Where do you see the demographics for BBC Sherlock, and does that demographic translate nicely back to the canon?
It attracts everyone, honestly, because with the popularity of crime shows, it has expanded. So there are people who, you know, like Paul, are over 40. There's also a very strong contingent of young fans, which I think is very good because it's bringing Sherlock Holmes to the younger generation. The movie surely did that, but in a different way. It's more of the Hollywood, let's make everything blow up and be awesome. And don't get me wrong, I really like the film. But I think BBC Sherlock, it has such a wide audience. It's not just for one group, but I think it's stronger in making Sherlock Holmes more attractive to younger viewers. And I'm not talking like kids and stuff, but to those like in their teens and 20s. This is a very weird way of saying it, but like making Sherlock Holmes like cool again, you know, in a way, like reinventing him in a way that's very, I don't know, very interesting and more realistic for us in this day and age rather than having it back in the Victorian era.
Very interesting comment I want to raise from Heidi in the audience. She's come back with some parallels between the TV adaptations and the J.K. Rowling Harry Potter books. Books were incredibly successful, but you know, much different from the films. So the adaptations in the films were very, very successful, and in the same way, the audience isn't stupid. They expect the book to be slower, and they expect the book to be different from the film. You can't be whiz-bang explosions. So the argument coming there from Heidi is that, you can't judge a book by its movie and vice versa. So they kind of sit alongside each other. Mm-hmm. Okay. Next question here. Go to Bert with this one first. Acknowledging that there are pros and cons to all the Holmes characterizations, what elements of each portrayal would you say were the positive ones from each type? So you could combine all three together and create the master type Holmes, and that's a question from Brenda Caldwell in the US. Hmm.
So all three, you mean the Benedict Cumberbatch and Downey and the traditional view? Well, you know, I think that, you don't want to get too academic about all this, but in fact, Holmes and Watson, you know, could be the last of the great sagas. The 56 short stories, the four novels, coming at a time when it did, Holmes, it was such a unique Victorian character at a time when just with thinking and intelligence and paying attention and noticing what everyone else didn't, and with certain specialized knowledge about tobacco ash and bloodstains and so on, you could pierce the veil of seemingly insoluble mysteries and perform miracles, like tell people how they spent their last 3 hours, deduce that their brother was a drunkard, and so on and so forth. So I think, those fundamental elements that the questioner is speaking about are Holmes the outsider, Holmes the character who is ahead of the audience, ahead of Watson, ahead of the reader, ahead of the police, ahead of evil. Holmes as someone with unique abilities, Holmes who lives in a different frame and pace than anyone else, goes days without eating, uses cocaine to stimulate his mind when work cannot stimulate it. I mean, those are the essential characters, the characterizations, attributes that make Holmes Holmes.
Fantastic. A quick question from, I'm going to pronounce this completely wrong now, but Yu Manabe from Japan. He sent some fantastic questions in. This is the first one. Is the physical ability of Sherlock Holmes, does it matter or not? We see in the Warner Brothers movie one complete end of the spectrum, and then in the traditional adaptations, perhaps the other end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So go back to team one on that one. What's your view on the physical, Christina?
Actually, Artie, do you want to take this one?
Can do, yeah. Yeah, we were talking about this before the debate briefly. And basically, I think it does matter because in the canon, Holmes is a fighter. He has some knowledge of Baritsu, whatever Baritsu is, but it's a martial art, and he is an amateur boxer. And I think if he didn't have this physical ability, he would be just a brain box. And perhaps, well, I think it makes him a bit more of a rounded character because the way he views himself in the canon, at least, he says at some point or Watson describes him as a brain box. But if you look at it closely, he actually isn't quite, because if you contrast him with his brother, Sherlock is the one of the two who goes out into the world and who does, in the words of BBC Sherlock, all the legwork. And he's the one who has to have some kind of physical ability because he goes into situations where he puts himself into physical danger. Whereas Mycroft, can solve things from his armchair, but he'll never leave it. He has the knowledge and the ability, but he would never go out in the street, and that's kind of where that contrast is. So I think it does matter that he has this fighting skill, and it has been shown in nearly every adaptation, at least the ones that I know of. They all show it to some extent, some better, some worse. I mean, I love Jeremy Brett, but the fight scenes in the Granada show weren't that great, and We have a fight in the BBC Sherlock, and obviously we have lots of fights on the Warner Brothers. So yeah, I do think that it is an important aspect of the character that makes them a bit more rounded.
Paul, do you want to comment on that for Team 3?
I'd just like to come back on something that Bert was saying in response to Brenda's question, actually, Steve, if I may, which was talking about Sherlock Holmes. One of the points Bert made quite correctly is that Sherlock Holmes was always ahead of his time. And this is perhaps my principal concern with the BBC series. To me, at least, for what it's worth, as an ex-police officer, I can't see any situation in which a modern-day police force may approach an independent consulting detective to ask for information about bloodstains or bruises on cadavers, etc. To me, that's not plausible. It is plausible within the context of the Victorian era, when, of course, science was beginning to emerge as a contrast to original theological perceptions about things. So this would be something that I would like to come back to and just make that point, that I think if you want a faithful portrayal of Sherlock Holmes, he has to be a man ahead of his time. It's very difficult for him to do that in the current time.
Okay. Bert, do you want to add something to either that point or the other point around...
Well, I think, to the question of does Holmes need to be physical, I think, yeah, the answer is yeah, absolutely. Holmes is a man who can bend an iron poker back after Grimsby Roylott bends it. He's an accomplished single-stick player. I mean, I think his boxing ability, and he is very much a creature of his magnificent creator. We like to play the game that Watson really wrote these stories, as we all know he did. But in fact, Sir Arthur, was an accomplished cricketer, a footballer, a skier, a bicyclist. He was a big man in lots of ways, and I think that physical aspect of Conan Doyle's personality imbues Sherlock Holmes.
Okay, so another question from Yui Manabe in Japan. Do you feel that in both of the recent adaptations that Watson has now eclipsed Holmes? Martin Freeman wins Best Supporting Actor, BAFTA, and Jude Law outcharms Robert Downey Jr., certainly in the first film. So go back to Christina on that one first. Have we seen with the modern adaptations that Watson is the man?
And I'm going to defer to Artie again because she is the John Watson major fan here. She knows what to talk about.
Yeah, I have the RAMC mug and everything. But I wouldn't say so much she has eclipsed Holmes, but it's certainly as a way of making Holmes accessible, you have to have a Watson that you can relate to as an audience member, because if you took Watson away and just looked at either BBC Sherlock or Robert Downey's Holmes, or even, the traditional version, you probably wouldn't be very interested in him. You'd find him a bit weird and a bit creepy, especially given that he's pretty much amoral. He's just interested in the puzzle. He doesn't care whether people live or die. He's just interested in solving the puzzle. So I think if you have a Watson that people can relate to, who is likable, who is sympathetic in some kind of fashion, that's a very important element to any kind of Holmes adaptation and to make it accessible to an audience.
Same question to Bert. I know certainly after the Robert Downey Jr. film came out, for the first time I saw a number of pastiches, so new Sherlock Holmes novels with Watson as the central character, with very little mention of Holmes. So do you feel that the balance in the in the Warner Brothers movies has tipped over to Watson?
No, I don't think so. But I think it is a. I don't think the balance has tipped over. But the, you know, you really have to underscore what a remarkable achievement it is for Freeman and for Law. You know, if you're an actor and you're called upon to play Sherlock Holmes, your biggest challenge is to make all the extraordinary things that he does and his eccentricities believable. But if you're presented with the opportunity to play Watson, Watson is pretty much an empty glass. I mean, he comes from Afghanistan. He's sort of adrift. He might be wounded in the shoulder. Maybe it's the leg. But you know, to fill that up with a real character, you know, to create a real human being, and particularly in this HD age when you see every pixel, you know, and you know, somebody once said the key to acting isn't really acting, it's listening. And that's the toughest thing for an actor in character to do, is sit in a scene, particularly with another extraordinary character like Holmes, who's in the spotlight, and not sort of disappear into the furniture. And so I think it's a. I think audiences are becoming more sophisticated about acting, and I think therefore the work that Freeman has done and that Jude Law has done is just more. People are more aware of it, I think.
A couple of
We've
comments.
We've come a long way from Nigel Bruce and Basil Rathbone.
Yeah, it's changed somewhat. And a couple of comments through from Tracy. I don't think Tracy's microphone is working. I've just opened it again just in case. But Tracy says that Sherlock Holmes has to be physical, but he shouldn't be turned into some sort of Superman and take away from his mental skills, I guess. And adding strength to Watson makes it better for the whole audience because you can relate to the stories better from that. Okay, so we'll
Steve, can I just say something about this as well on behalf of the traditionalists? I think it's really important. I mean, the question was, is Watson growing as a character? And I think perhaps, again, conceding to my age, I first became aware of Sherlock Holmes and Watson through the Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce movies. And everybody knows that, of course, the Nigel Bruce portrayal of Watson was as a kind of bumbling idiot. But, of course, it's very important to remember that in the canon, Watson was a doctor of medicine. He was a clever, erudite character in his own right, and that image of him was lost in the late 30s and 40s as a consequence of those films. So I think what's actually happened is we're just restoring that credibility to Watson's characters. So yeah, I do believe that Watson's becoming more significant. He was always a sounding board for Holmes, and Holmes concedes to that many times in the cabin, saying that, you know, he was perhaps not an illuminator of light, but he was a conduit for it. So I think that was what I would like to say about that, that Watson is actually returning perhaps to the kind of Watson that Conan Doyle had intended in the original.
Fantastic. Okay, an excellent question from Carrie Carlson that's come in, which is, is there some concern that Holmes is perceived as some sort of role model for new generations? And how does that adaptation present Holmes? So going back to what you said earlier, I think it was Christina said about how, you know, the Sherlock in BBC Sherlock is extremely cold. And is that a bad role model to be pushing forward rather than the more comic and aloof Downey Jr. Holmes?
Well, I think it's important to note that most young children will not be watching Sherlock because it is an adult drama. How is it? He isn't the nicest person, no. But he is played very cold, and very intelligent, very detached, and I think it's important to realize that the way that Cumberbatch plays him, he said there's like with maybe like a touch of Asperger's or some sort of autism. I think it's really bringing into light how people with such a highly intelligent mind are perceived in today's society. Because back in Victorian era, everyone was like very, you know, surprised and amazed at what he did, and if someone came up to you today and could tell you your entire life story, like how they say in Sherlock, they'd say piss off. It's like that sort of knowledge, whether it's like Big Brother watching you or just the internet age, you get very put off about it. It frightens you, it annoys you, it angers you. So everyone calls Sherlock freak, and I suspect maybe it's not necessarily a role model, but showing that there are still a lot, there's discrimination in today's society. There, how we perceive things and how we perceive people who are very intelligent isn't always very kind. And I think that part is important. He says it in The Great Games, like, don't make people into heroes. Heroes don't exist, and if they did, I wouldn't be one of them. So he tells the audience himself, like, you know, don't look up to me. So I think maybe that answers it for itself. I don't know if anyone else had anything to add onto that.
Can I pass over to Vida? She's got her hand up. So Vida, you want to come in?
Yes, hello. I think that Holmes himself was never really meant to be a hero. He was never meant to be heroic in that sense that we admire him for his morals. It was simply for his deductions and for his intelligence. And that's why, that's all I wanted to say, really.
Yeah, okay. It definitely goes with what we were thinking.
I think, Steve,
it's important to emphasize that the foibles that he had as a character, his sexual ambivalence, the drugs, and of course frequently breaking the law in order to pursue his case, that those are clearly not admirable qualities, perhaps. But I think what it is worthy of some consideration is that he will stop at nothing. He's totally determined to triumph over evil. So I think that's perhaps worthy of being a role model, sweeping aside the other issues that I mentioned.
A fantastic comment from Tracy over the web, a parallel with comparing Sherlock Holmes to Hugh Laurie's House. We love to watch him, but we wouldn't want to be like him, or we wouldn't want him anywhere in our lives. But there's a parallel there, I guess, where House is constantly trying to solve the mystery as well in there. We've got two very tough questions that I want to get in the few minutes that we have before the end. They've both been raised by the audience members, and it's not a surprise that they've done it. I was expecting them to come through. How do teams 1 and 2 respond to the understandable, perhaps, but definite, obvious absence of Holmes's substance abuse, and how does that weaken the adaptation? So we'll start that with Bert first, I think.
Well, I don't think it weakens it. I think it strengthens it. I mean, time has moved on. You know, Conan Doyle, the late 19th century, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, lots of folks experimented with substances that we now know to be deeply addictive and troubling. And usage of cocaine in the 21st century in terms of films is not something that's going to wind up on the screen lightly. And in Downey, you have someone who is notorious in his own personal life, having come to grips with his own drug addiction. So I do not think that the 7% solution of cocaine that drove Nick Meyer's film and Nick Meyer's book and so on, and that has appeared in the canon, is fundamental to understanding and appreciating Holmes. And I don't think I think it was a brilliant idea not to touch it in the Downey picture.
Christina, do you want to comment to that?
Did anyone else want to say it? I feel bad hogging the microphone.
Oh, you're fine. But it's not completely ignored in either adaptation either, though. It is hinted at. For that matter, in the Warner Brothers movie, there's the sequence where Watson complains to Holmes that the medication he was taking is meant for eye surgery, which is, you know, a very kind of subtle way of saying that that's what he's doing, that won't necessarily be picked up by the younger audiences and things that they don't think that they don't want to alienate by having this huge drug addiction problem kind of come into it. But I completely agree with what was being said about it was different in Victorian times. Cocaine was not an illegal substance that was pushed, you know, in the same way that it is now. It was a completely different situation at the time that Holmes would have been doing such drugs. Much like how in the BBC version, to a certain extent, they've actually eliminated the pipe smoking idea with the nicotine patches. It's another situation where we have a substance that isn't necessarily as deadly or as addictive, you know, as horrible as drugs are when they're viewed by audiences, but is becoming less and less acceptable for media productions today to do that sort of glamorization of smoking. It's just another situation where the climate around the substance has changed, as well as the character.
And it's alluded to in Sherlock with the drug bust.
Yes.
So it's like Sherlock, there was a problem in the past, because John kept saying, like, you wouldn't find anything recreational in here, and Sherlock's like, shut up. So, I mean, it is alluded to, it's just not put out there, because I think it would maybe take away a little bit, because a lot of it's, like, you know, overly dramatic or trite, and, like, with everything that, you know, Bert and Taylor have said, there's things that you can't really show on television that you shouldn't, because of all the glamorization and everything.
But Mark Gatiss...
Sorry, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat have been asked this question in several interviews, and I think they answered it very well, and they said that, you know, obviously the perception of taking cocaine today is, as you say, it's very different to the Victorian times. And, I mean, today's perception is, it might have been more exotic in those days, but today, if you take drugs, you're considered an idiot. It's not the same at all. And going back to the previous question about, you know, is this a role model? Of course they would have to, you know, suggest that maybe there was a problem in the past, but then, you know, he's dealt with that, he's moved on. Because, you know, there is issues, the fact that obviously this is attracting, the BBC series is certainly attracting a younger audience. And so it's, for that point of view, it has to be the correct stance, surely, to say that he's giving up smoking, and the fact that, you know, he's moved on from the drug addiction.
But the thing is also, you have to take into account, what does it add to the character if you give him a drug problem? Or what does it say about the character? And what it says is, he's got an addictive personality. And that is 100% true of Sherlock Holmes. And it is, you know, we talked about the illusions and things like that. And I don't think it weakens the adaptation at all, you know, because it is present there in the background, and it is something that says something about the character of Sherlock Holmes.
Okay, so another tough question. This comes from Caitlin. A lot of people have commented that there are more homosexual undertones in the BBC Sherlock adaptation than have ever been seen in any previous Sherlock adaptation. Do you think that this was deliberately put in for younger generations to take the adaptation better?
Oh, Lord.
Can I go ahead and start? I know, right? I can go ahead and start that argument by pointing out, though, that also has a situation going on that's very similar to the climate being changed. In a modern-day setting, two grown men moving in together, it's not the same. We view it in a different way. So there would be that undertone of, are they a couple that live together, and, you know, they're of a certain age, and things like that. Well, you wouldn't necessarily have had that in a Victorian time when something was more common.
Does anybody else want to make a comment on that?
Well, the only thing I would add is, you know, I would really be shocked if that was consciously added in for those reasons into the BBC Sherlock. You know, this has been a recurring theme. Billy Wilder made a film, The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, with Robert Stephens and Colin Blakely back in the 70s.
Yes. Lovely
and,
film.
Yeah, it is a lovely film. And Watson, as Colin Blakely, becomes very alarmed at the suggestion that the reason why Holmes is not seducing this ballerina or whoever she is because, like Tchaikovsky, you know, he has other preferences. And so it's used for great comic effect in that picture as Watson really tries to find out exactly what Holmes' feelings are in this matter. But I think, you know, it's like the other speaker said, I think it just reflects the current time. You know, men are much, much more affectionate today, and there are different dynamics in these relationships today than they were a while ago.
And the notion that Holmes and Watson could possibly be gay is nothing new. This has been going on for ages, this debate. And, you know, the BBC, it likes to poke fun at it, I think. And how they've already said, with the new climate and everything, it's more easy to do that for sure. But this is not, it's not a new notion.
Can I just pick this up? Oh, sorry.
Go for it.
I was just going to say from the perspective of the traditionist, I think what I would say is one of the attractions about Sherlock Holmes is that he's obviously a troubled character. He's deep and he's dark and he's melancholic. And I think if you start removing some of the issues we've been talking about, the drug addictions and perhaps his sexual inclinations and so on and so forth, what you end up with is a very sterile character. Somebody who's quite transparent, and that doesn't help to develop the intrigue and the sense of interest in the character. So I think that there has to be a point at which you say, well, how far do we take that? Do we turn this into a guy that is totally politically correct, doesn't want to upset anybody, doesn't want to offend people? And I think that would turn Sherlock Holmes into somebody transparent. I think what attracts a lot of people is he does have those other darker sides to his character. I think illusion is fine. Perhaps it shouldn't be emphasized, but it also shouldn't be totally retracted from the character either in the modern portrayals of him.
Okay. A couple of real quick one-liner answers from questions from the audience. We've got one from Margaret Bridges, and this one goes to teams 1 and 3. Just wondering if any of you Brits are put off by Robert Downey Jr.'s British accent in exclamation marks. Christina?
I'm American, so Sherlockology, you want to take it?
Okay, Sherlockology, Jules? In the game?
I can only say it from a personal point of view. I think that Robert Downey Jr.'s Chaplin was brilliant. I think that perhaps, yes, from a British point of view, like I'm sure every Brit trying to be American, you know, it doesn't quite sit completely well, no matter how good they are. It's not quite as authentic as, say, for instance, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch. With sounding as a Sherlock Holmes, I for me personally, for us as a team, I think that's it's a little bit, it grates a little bit on us.
Okay, and Vida, do you want to comment on that for Team 3?
It is slightly grating, but I think that Downey Jr. does a very good job for an American of taking on the mantle of such an iconically British character and doing it to the best of his abilities. Well, British Sherlock Holmes is actually the first film that I saw, the way that I got introduced to Sherlock Holmes, and it didn't bother me as much as I would expect it to.
The other related comment, the other related question is around the choice of actor for the two non-traditional adaptations. Downey Jr. has been in a lot of films, and can he make... So this one's to Bert, I guess. Can he make Sherlock Holmes his in the same way that Benedict Cumberbatch has made it his character?
Yes, I think he can. But, you know, the audience plays an important part in that equation. People tend to remember the first, you know, Paul mentioned earlier, he encountered Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce, and that will forever sort of stamp his sense. And there's been another generation for which it's Jeremy Brett. I think there will be another generation for which it's Robert Downey. You know, the only sort of unfortunate thing about Downey, I think he does a very good accent, particularly considering he was born in New York, but he can't play tall. You know, it's he's not you know, 6'1" or 6'2" and but I think considering all that, sure, I think he will be another generation's Holmes.
Fantastic. Well, I think we're probably going to have to wrap it up there, guys. Just a massive thank you to all the participants in the great debate. I'm sure that the audience members and everybody that listens to this recording will thank everybody for the time and effort that they've put in. It's quite amazing that we've had fans from 23 different countries around the world joining in the audience tonight. Can I remind everybody that the debate will continue on SherlockHolmes.com on the forums there. And also, if you enjoyed this, there are two wonderful podcasts that basically spend most of their time doing this, talking about Sherlock Holmes. And that's the Baker Street Babes. Also, I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. Absolutely wonderful. One of the best things I ever did was to download those guys. And they're free on iTunes and also from their websites as well. So if you want to continue listening to these wonderful debates, then you can do that. So thank you very much, everybody. And I hope this is the start of some more fun like this next year.
Well, thank you, Stephen. Great job.
Yeah, thanks,
thank
guys.
Thank you, Steve, so much.
Thank you. Well done, Steve.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?